Today is Wednesday, January 31st. We're going to wrap up blood information today.
Okay, so first blood typing question there. What blood type carries both an A and an Rh antigen?
A positive.
Okay, so it's face value. If you've got the antigens, then that's part of your blood type. Just kind of thinking outside the box, is there anything else that might carry an A and an Rh antigen? AB positive, yeah. So, you know, it doesn't say anything about B here, so you're right to assume A positive, but yeah, there could possibly be AB positive here too. Good. Let's see, what blood type is considered our universal donor?
O negative,
good. And then why is this not entirely accurate when we talk about whole blood donations? What does O negative carry in their blood plasma?
Antibodies,
good. And those antibodies could potentially be built against what? A, anti-B, and Rh, yeah. So if you give whole blood from an O negative person to pretty much anybody, you're giving them anti-A, B, and Rh antibodies that could potentially fight their own antigens. Is this a big risk for the person receiving the transfusion?
No,
it's a small risk. Nonetheless, something we want to just tuck in the back of our heads and say, hey, this is just something to consider, that we are giving those antibodies in that whole blood transfusion. Does that make sense about O negative?
And you said they'll give what, A, B, and what else?
Yeah, they carry potentially an anti-A, anti-B, and an anti-Rh.
Oh.
Yeah. Any questions on this one? Feel good so far? Okay. Let's see. What blood type has both the A and the B antigens and lacks the Rh factor?
AB
negative. Good. Okay, so how did you know they were?
Just AB, would that be correct? Or do you have to have that negative?
I think to be more specific, they want. Yeah, put that negative
in. I've seen it.
Come test time, it's going to be a multiple choice. So you just pick that negative one. Yeah. Let's see. We've got a plasma of a blood type that carries both anti-A and anti-B antibodies.
O.
Yeah, good. So this one is O. It could be either one, and the reason is you only develop the anti-Rh antibodies upon sensitization or exposure. So you can be male or female and 50 years old or 100 years old, never been pregnant, never had a transfusion, and never have formed those anti-Rh antibodies. So yeah, we don't have enough information there to know. So did you pick O? Were you able to get that far? What blood types can A positive receive?
A negative.
Good. That's it. So A positive, A negative, O positive, O negative. There's four types they can receive. The catch is you can't give this person anything with blood type
B.
Right. And they carry an anti-B antibody. Okay. What blood types can O positive receive? Just O positive and O negative. Okay, and they carry anti-A and anti-B antibodies, and so that excludes anybody with A, B, or AB blood. Okay. Let's see, would you recommend giving O positive cells to a person with B positive blood? And let's kind of clarify what that means. When we're talking about the cells, we're talking about the antigens that are found on those red blood cells. So what do you think about this? Good? So what antigens is O positive giving to A positive?
Rh.
Rh, yeah, that's it. And has A positive seen the Rh antigen? We're good, right? So I'm not giving anything foreign. I'm not introducing anything that might cause an immune reaction. So yeah, this is a good transfusion for the cells. I'm not introducing something that would trigger those antibodies.
So you're saying like the cells just give antigens?
Cells just give antigens. If we give the blood plasma, that gives antibodies. And if you give whole blood, you give all of it. Yep, so, okay, if you give blood cells, you're giving antigens. Blood cells are giving antigens. If you give just blood plasma, you're giving antibodies. And if you give whole blood, then you're giving both. Okay, so you're getting both antigens and antibodies. This question here makes sense about O positive giving to B positive. Okay. So this time we're talking about whole blood from an AB positive person. Is this a good idea to give to a person with B positive? So what am I introducing that's foreign?
The A antigen.
The A antigen, right. So I'm giving a foreign antigen. It is that A antigen. The B-positive person doesn't have that antigen. In fact, what would they do to that antigen?
Agglutinate
it, right. So we don't want to introduce a foreign antigen that would cause that recipient person to agglutinate and clump that blood. Does this question make sense? Let's see, we talked a little bit in class last period about the disorder that results when you have an Rh negative mom and she's potentially pregnant with an Rh positive baby. It's a mouthful, isn't it? That's it. Hemolytic disease of the newborn, and there's an even fancier word. That's it. Yep. Erythroblastosis fetalis. So bottom line is, if you think of it as hemolytic, then hemo is blood and lytic is lysis, right? And so it technically causes those blood cells to be clumped by antibodies and then they rupture. And that rupturing process is what can cause major damage. Okay, so that term is halfway down page 30 if you need it.
So do we have to remember?
Hemolytics, okay. I think I give you both on the test. But yeah, if you see hemolytic disease, erythroblastosis, fetalis is alternate for the same. Agglutination, good. The clumping that occurs when an antibody binds an antigen, that is called agglutination. And I'm trying hard here not to say the word clot, because clotting is a totally different process we're going to talk about today. So clotting is not agglutination. Agglutination is the clumping that occurs when antibodies bind antigens. It's a transfusion reaction when we have those things that don't mix, you know, foreign antigens introduced into somebody with antibodies built against them. Okay, so that's just a couple of questions for review. Is this helpful? Okay, why don't I do another set of maybe 8 questions for Monday, and we'll start again Monday with, you know, repeating this stuff again. Okay. Anything else on blood typing I can take you back through? Yeah, try page 32. See how you do with that. There are answers in the detail announcements. Just scroll to the bottom of the news, and they're linked at the very bottom of that announcement. Let's see, in class on Monday, we were talking about hemoglobin, so I'd like to take you back there. It's on the bottom of page 23. Just want to hit this as a review before we keep on moving. So what type of blood cell carries hemoglobin? Good. Erythrocytes, red blood cells, good. And the hemoglobin molecule has four polypeptide chains. Each polypeptide chain has a heme group. And what metal is found in each heme group?
Iron.
Iron, good. Why is iron an important part of your heme group? Bingo, good. Oxygen binds to that iron molecule. I should mention that oxygen binds reversibly with that iron on the heme group, and being a reversible binder, that means it can join up with iron and it can also break up with iron. And so that's going to be a concept that we find interesting as we get into respiratory, because other gases like carbon monoxide bind irreversibly with the iron on the heme group. So that's just something we'll kind of tuck in the back of our minds and come back to later. So for one hemoglobin molecule, how many oxygens can bind?
Four.
Good. So when oxygen binds to the hemoglobin molecule, we call it oxyhemoglobin, and oxyhemoglobin tends to have a bright red color. When oxygen unbinds from hemoglobin, we call this deoxyhemoglobin, and now what color does the blood take on?
Red.
Dark red, right. So like we talked before, there's not ever a time when blood is truly blue. That's a trick of the eye with the way the skin's melanin translates that color to our brains. And of course, carbon dioxide can also ride on the hemoglobin molecule. It's just not competing for a seat. So we'll talk more about carbon dioxide when we get later on into the respiratory system. So this is a hemoglobin molecule. You'll notice it is changing shape as it binds and unbinds that oxygen. And we're going to talk about something called affinity later on in respiratory. I wanted to introduce it to you now. We say that oxygen and hemoglobin have an affinity for each other. What does affinity mean? They like each other, right? So if you have an affinity for chocolate, then you like chocolate, right? So hemoglobin and oxygen like each other, and in fact, hemoglobin is willing to change its shape to allow more oxygen to go for a ride. So I kind of imagine it like a taxi cab sitting there with a door open saying, hey, I've got a seat ready and waiting for you. Why don't you get on in and go for a ride? And that's what hemoglobin does. It kind of puts itself out there and says, hey, oxygen, I like you and I want you to come for a ride with me. And so it changes conformation like you see here to encourage more oxygens to be transported. Ideally, we're going to learn in the respiratory system, you want the max number of oxygens transported. What is the max number a hemoglobin can carry?
Four.
Yeah. So that's what we're doing here. We're actually making it easier to transport those total of four oxygen molecules. All right, so that should take you down to the bottom of that page 23. How about questions there? Do you guys have any questions on hematocrit? We covered that, I believe, a little bit on Monday.
Put one on the board.
Gotcha. Let's say we've got blood plasma that makes, let's do 55%. We know that buffy coat. 1%, good. And then if we're looking for the hematocrit, 100 minus 56, good. Looks like 44%. If you were to get that number of 44% for your hematocrit, would you say this is normal or abnormal?
Normal.
Yeah, almost spot on normal. Yeah. Normally, we're looking at about 45% of your blood composed of erythrocytes. So a hematocrit of 44% is about spot on there. Okay. Let's do another one. Now, we talked on Monday about assuming that that Buffy coat's always 1%. Let's say that we have blood plasma of, say, 42%. And we want to figure out how many erythrocytes are the percentage in blood volume. So we've got those two things make up, what, 43%? 57, good. Is 57% a normal number for a hematocrit?
No, it's too high.
It's too high. And so I know in lab you've talked about issues with hematocrit. What does this look like? What could be going on here? That's it. Polycythemia, yeah. So maybe life at a high altitude, maybe we've got bone marrow cancer, but again, one of those two things could be the underlying issue. Or you could have dehydration that makes your blood plasma volume go down and your blood cells actually, the ratio gets out of whack there. Do you need one more?
Okay.
One more, okay. Okay, so we're going to assume that 1% for the Buffy coat layer. Let's say this time we've got a hematocrit of 34%, and we want to know what percentage is the plasma. Yeah, something like 65%. Yeah, just basically add up to 100. Yeah.
I felt like on our lab picture,
it's way more.
Yeah.
Way out there compared to that.
Yeah.
I feel like the way she even worded it in a question,
yeah,
in a quiz, was
confusing.
Anybody remember the question?
I got
it wrong. Like 89 or 30 or something. 30.
Yes, yeah, it's total height and.
Oh, measuring a column.
It's like a bunch of words that understand
play.
Yeah. So you guys are measuring the column of a centrifuged blood?
Worded in like two sentences.
Okay, so maybe you were doing like the column of centrifuged blood and looking at how much each portion contributes. Yeah.
I don't even know.
Yeah.
I don't know what quiz she gave, so.
Yeah.
You made it easier.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, that's basically it.
Wow. That's really easy. Yeah. Yeah, she threw like division in there, yeah, and multiplication and subtraction.
Like a percentage?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You divide the difference.
Yeah, okay. You divide the difference.
Oh, you can divide by like plasma plus total height.
That sounds about right. Yeah, so you're measuring the height of the column and then taking a percentage of it.
But really, all you want to do is
it's
that.
Just in a, yeah, I know.
Yeah, that I kind of skipped that step of measuring the column. Yeah.
But that's basically the same thing.
It's basically the same thing. All she was doing was measuring the columns for you and then turning it into a percentage. Yeah.
So we could still get the answer by setting it up the way you did.
You can, yeah. If you don't have to measure columns, then yeah, I shortcut you there. Any questions on hematocrit? Let me take you on over to page 24. We'll talk a little more about red blood cells there. If you have a highlighter handy, you'll want to highlight at the very top of your page. the normal number in a red blood cell count, about 4 to 6 million red blood cells is common in a drop of blood. Okay, so 4 to 6 million red blood cells. Good number to know. Let me explain what it means to be a cubic millimeter of blood. That's a very, very small volume of blood. It's like a drop of blood. And if you consider that you're transporting around 5 liters of blood, you know, multiply that out, one drop over 5 liters, you're talking, in reality, trillions of red blood cells that you're transporting. So when we say 4 to 6 million, I don't mean to imply that you only have 4 to 6 million red blood cells in your whole body. You have just 4 to 6 million in one little drop. So that's an amazing number of red blood cells that you're circulating. Another number to know is their lifespan. You'll want to highlight that too. They live for around 120 days. That's about 4 months' time. You may wonder why red blood cells don't live very long, and it's due to the fact that they don't have a nucleus. So why does having no nucleus mean that your lifespan is shortened? You can't go through mitosis. You don't have a brain, do you? So no nucleus means you don't know how to divide. You don't know how to think, really. You're just like a drone riding through the bloodstream. So yeah, there's no nucleus to do repairs. That means that when these cells get worn out, your body just removes them from circulation and replaces them with new. And then we also have very few organelles in red blood cells. And again, that has to do with we're really not looking to repair them. We're looking for them to just function as gas delivery vehicles. Drop off the oxygen, pick up the CO2. Since we're constantly recycling red blood cells, let's talk about the recycling process next. For people who have a spleen, that is the primary location for recycling to occur. We can live without a spleen, and if you do have a spleen removed, then your body is going to then shift this function over to the liver. So your spleen is actually a very spongy organ. And if you think about the way a sponge is set up, a lot of holes in those sponges, just like spleen tissue. And when red blood cells travel through that spongy tissue, the ragged, worn out ones get removed from circulation. And so your spleen then begins the process of helping to break down those red blood cells. And so likewise, if you don't have a spleen, then your liver picks up that job. We're going to recycle and reuse most of what a red blood cell is made of. In fact, the iron is kept and used to make new red blood cells. The heme group that actually holds that iron is broken down to form bile. And that's actually a job of your liver. Let me take a detour with you for just a moment. What color is bile? Yellow, green. Okay, and so later on we'll learn that bile helps break down fats in your digestive system. And in fact, bile is broken down even further into something that's brown in color. And that's why your feces have a brown tint to them. And so we're not going to waste this stuff. We're going to reuse it. You know, we get a second life out of that heme group. Something else I want to mention, if you get a bruise, you know, initially a bruise may be black and blue, right? Okay, so what does the blue color indicate? Deoxygenated, good. So those cells, those red blood cells in that area have little oxygen. That's the blue color, okay? Go through several days and that bruise changes color. Whatever colors do bruises turn?
Yellow.
Yeah. So you may have a yellowish green bruise, and that is from the breakdown of guess what? Not bile, but the heme. Yeah. So if you have a yellow or green color bruise, you'll know that it's further along in the healing process and that your body is degrading or breaking down that heme group. And eventually the next step is to clear that area. Those globin chains are also used to make proteins, so we don't waste anything here. We do reuse and recycle pretty much all parts of those red blood cells. And just interestingly, the yellow color of your urine also comes from the breakdown of hemoglobin. So, you know, there's a lot we can learn about your body's health by looking at the color of your skin, right? To see if you're yellow, to see if your poop is brown and your pee is yellow. So we know a lot about your spleen, your liver, and other organs if we can look at those kinds of things. Okay, so since we're constantly recycling red blood cells and removing them from circulation, let's talk about how we make new cells. In the middle of your page, there's a term there called hematopoiesis. So what is hema?
Blood.
Good. And this process, this name here, implies making all types of blood cells, red, white, and platelets. Hematopoiesis is going to occur in the red bone marrow of your bones. So where is red bone marrow often found in an adult? Marrow cavity, yeah, good. And those spongy bone tissues have hollow spaces, and that's also a good location for red bone marrow. There's a cell that gives rise to all of our blood cells, red, white, and platelets, and this stem cell is called a hemocytoblast. Let's break the word down. What is hemo again?
Blood.
Blood and cyto. Good. And how about a blast?
Building.
Yep, so it's a forming or a building or a growing cell. So hemocytoblasts build new red blood cells, new white blood cells, and new platelets. I'm going to show you this picture. This is kind of a family tree of blood cells, and you'll notice at the very top is the ancestor, you might say, to all of our blood cells. It is called the hemocytoblast, and it gives rise to all cell types in the bloodstream. So if you have a problematic hemocytoblast, ooh, wow, what does that indicate? What could happen down the line? So if you've got problems at the top, every cell type in the bloodstream is affected, right? You may have problems making red blood cells, white blood cells, and even platelets. So yeah, it's really critical that we have healthy hemocytoblasts that can do their jobs. So we're going to ignore the lineage here for white blood cells and platelets. Instead, I'm going to focus only on how to make red blood cells. So the process of making red blood cells is called a similar term. It's called erythropoiesis, and it is driven by a hormone called EPO. EPO is short for erythropoietin. I know you thought we were done with hormones, right? The dirty truth here is that you're never done with the hormones. They come all semester, yeah? Okay, so let's talk about how we know we have low blood oxygen levels. You know, do you want your brain to be the organ that senses low blood oxygen? Could that be dangerous? That could be really dangerous, right? You could die from having low oxygen. Do you want your heart to be the organ to sense low oxygen?
No.
Probably not a good idea either, right? So kidneys are actually the organs that sense low blood oxygen level. And what are they doing all day, every day? Do they handle your blood?
They're
filtering it, good. So they're in direct contact with your blood all day, every day. And if you have low blood oxygen content traveling through those kidneys, the kidneys in turn release a hormone called erythropoietin, or EPO for short. Now this hormone travels to your bone marrow, and red marrow specifically, right? Not yellow marrow. And EPO tells your bone marrow to increase red blood cell production. Okay, so a couple of things to remember here. What organ releases EPO?
Kidneys.
Good. What is the stimulus for EPO?
Low oxygen.
Good. And then finally, what is the target organ of EPO?
Bone marrow.
The bone marrow. Good. repeat those three questions. First question is, what organ releases EPO?
Kidneys.
Good. The second question is, what is the stimulus for EPO release?
Low oxygen.
Good. Okay, and the third question is, what is the target of EPO?
Red bone marrow.
Red bone marrow.
Good.
So third question, what is the target of EPO? And it's the red bone marrow. It only takes around 3 to 7 days to make new red blood cells. So let me give you an example here. You know, we live at a pretty low altitude. I think our altitude around here is like in the 100-foot range, so, you know, we're pretty much at sea level. If you were to go spend the weekend in some fairly tall mountains, just a weekend, then when you arrive in those mountains, you might experience low blood oxygen. And of course, your kidneys start releasing EPO. And how many days later should you expect to have an increase in your red blood cell population?
3 to 7 days.
So if you just spend, say, 2 days in the mountains, are you going to benefit from EPO? Nah, you're going to feel like crap while you're there, right? Okay, so the low oxygen level is not going to be something you can rectify in just 2 days. It takes around 3 to 7 to get that new population in circulation. So when you come back home, you'll feel better because you'll have more red blood cells, but it didn't help you while you were in those mountains, right? Let me show you a picture here on the right-hand side. I know you probably can't read the fine print over there, but I think it is obvious that you've got nuclei in most of those cells. And then the bottom two pictures, you've got fairly clear-looking cells. So when we make a red blood cell, it undergoes a division process in the red bone marrow. And these nuclei here are present until we exit the bone marrow. This cell here that's clear has no nucleus, and it's called a reticulocyte. So your red bone marrow ejects that reticulocyte out of the circulation. So the problem with the reticulocyte is it's an immature red blood cell. Its hemoglobin has not yet matured. Give it a couple of days, and then it's ready to transport oxygen. So if we want to measure your potential or your capability of transporting oxygen in about 2 to 3 days, we measure your reticulocyte population, not your erythrocytes. So what's happening to your erythrocytes all the time? They're dying, right? So the reticulocytes are the babies, right? Okay, they're the up-and-coming potential red blood cells. So what is the problem with measuring your erythrocyte population for an accurate view? They're dying. So every day you're losing red blood cells. If you want to know what your potential is for making red blood cells, the reticulocyte count is actually a more accurate view. So the erythrocytes are constantly in a fluctuation. Those reticulocytes actually tell us, hey, this is what's going to be here in about 2 days or so. All right, anybody still need this slide? I just want to mention something called blood doping. Have you heard of blood doping before? So if you've heard of blood doping, then what are people doping the blood with? People who do blood doping can take injections of erythropoietin or EPO, and they do this because they're athletes and they're looking for a competitive advantage. So if you take injections of EPO, what does this do to your red blood cell population?
Increases
them, good. And what do red blood cells primarily transport?
Oxygen,
good. And in combination with oxygen, glucose and oxygen is taken to your mitochondria and you make what?
ATP,
good. So that's why people who take EPO injections are looking for a competitive advantage. They're actually looking to increase their energy levels. Okay, so one sports group that has traditionally used EPO is the cycling world, and there's been a lot of controversy about people using EPO, it is hard to detect in the bloodstream. And Lance Armstrong was one person who, you know, said for many years, no, I didn't blood dope. And then he finally came out years later and said, I did, I blood dope. So he was taking EPO injections and giving him a competitive advantage. Do you see any health risk with taking EPO injections? What might those be? Too many red blood cells, right. And the name of that condition is? Polycythemia, that's right. So if you've got polycythemia, what does that do to your hematocrit values?
Increases them,
good. And then that means your blood plasma, in terms of the ratio there, is actually less than what it should be. So what kinds of problems might we see that arise from polycythemia? Could be elevated hemoglobin, yep. If you've got polycythemia, you may have stroke. You could have heart attack. You know, your heart has to work harder to pump this more viscous blood. So there are health risks associated with having had EPO injections. So the decision these people that do blood doping have to make is, okay, I take EPO injections and I can win the race. It gives me a competitive advantage. Or the other risk is stroke. So they chose
choose stroke,
right? I mean, that's the decision they're making there is, you know, they're weighing their risks and hoping that they don't have a stroke or heart attack from having had doped up blood with EPO. Yep. So if they blood dope today, how long would it take for their body to rid themselves of those extra red blood cells? 120 days, yeah. So, you know, if they're blood doping constantly, they can even increase those red blood cell populations for months. Something else people do competitively is they sleep in chambers that make their body naturally produce more red blood cells. If you were going to sleep in a specialized chamber that induced EPO production, would you sleep in one that had extra oxygen or actually low levels of oxygen? Yeah, I want to increase my red blood cell population, so I should...
Low oxygen.
Yeah. It releases the EPO. Exactly. So that's even harder to diagnose because, you know, there's no blood doping there. There's no EPO going on. You're just sleeping in a chamber that's hypobaric or low oxygen concentration. That's kind of risky too, right?
Yeah.
Gotta keep that brain alive.
So get yourself.
Yeah. Like, yeah, calm chamber, low oxygen chamber, yeah. Do you guys have questions on EPO or erythropoiesis? Feel pretty comfortable here? More or less? Okay. Let's see, about halfway down your page, let's talk about the dietary requirements. It's in bold there. What dietary requirements do we need to make red blood cells? Yeah, we need that first blank there is iron. Good, that first blank is iron. What about the second blank?
B12.
B12, good. Where do you get B12 from? Meat, dairy, yeah, protein. Animal products only, so if you're a strict vegetarian or a vegan, you actually have to supplement with vitamin B12. It only comes from animal products. The catch about taking B12 as an oral supplement, you know, pill form, is it's poorly absorbed by your digestive system. The most effective way to ramp up your B12 is to get an injection. Yeah. Where do you get folic acid from? Whole grains, things like cereals. Go down the cereal aisle at the grocery store, crackers. They'll oftentimes advertise that we have all your folic acid for the day. Yeah. So folic acid is not something that is animal product based. It's mostly like whole grains and things of that sort. Folic acid is also important for females who are in their reproductive years. because it is necessary for preventing a birth defect called spina bifida. Heard of that one before? Okay, so spina bifida is a neural tube problem. It means the spinal cord doesn't heal or close properly in babies that are growing. So that folic acid is good for two reasons, red blood cells and for potential pregnancies. All right, so just a chance to review here. What is the stimulus for EPO? Low blood oxygen, good. All right, looks like we're ready to flip on over to 25. Do y'all have any questions on 24 before we head there? Everybody get the attendance roster today? Stacy, y'all get it back? Okay. Let's talk about white blood cells or leukocytes. We've often heard their job is to fight infection. They are very specialized though in what they do. So fighting infection is just one facet or one part of what those white blood cells do. Because white blood cells are very specific in what they target and fight, they gotta have a brain. So they have a nucleus. They also have to have organelles because they do sometimes live many years. We can also classify them by whether or not they have granules in their cytoplasm. And white blood cells can travel in and out of your bloodstream by diapedesis. Translated, diapedesis means to walk through. Okay, so diapedesis translated means to walk through. So think about your red blood cells. Do they ever need to leave your bloodstream? They do not, right? Red blood cells are like little drones. All they do is pick up oxygen and deliver it, pick up CO2 and deliver it. That's all they do. They don't have to think about it, and they never need to leave your bloodstream. White blood cells, however, need to go to the site of an infection. So they're hopping in and out of your bloodstream. They're using that bloodstream to carry them to the next location. And so they can travel across the wall of your vessels and get to the site of the infection. You'll want to know this number here, 6,000 to 9,000 is the normal white blood cell count. And again, that's in a cubic millimeter or a drop of blood. What was the normal count for a red blood cell population? Millions, yeah. So 4 to 6 million red blood cells compared to 6 to 9,000 white blood cells, that's a 10 to 1 difference. You have 10 times as many red blood cells in a drop of blood compared to a white blood cell population. So even though white blood cells are really important, they're very specialized in what they do. That's why they can live for hours to days. Some of them live for years. They're called memory cells. But a lot of the ones that are phagocytes and eat your enemy, they die. We just remove them from the bloodstream and we replace them with new ones. So let's talk about the granulocytes and the agranulocytes. These are two groups of white blood cells. So which one of these sets of groups has granules? Good, granulocytes. Which group has oftentimes large round nuclei? Agranulocytes, good. Which ones often have lobe-shaped or sausage-shaped nuclei? The granulocytes, right, good. Where would you place the fills? Granulocytes and the sites? Agranulocytes, good. So let's talk about the granulocytes first. They are actually named by a color of dye that they prefer. So the prefix eosin, baso, neutro is actually indicative of the color that they prefer to stain. So let's walk through those first. All right, so we've got neutrophils first, and they're the ones that happen to have a neutral colored stain, sometimes light pink, light blue, pale colored. And the nucleus is also very classically lobed, usually three lobes for a neutrophil. All right, so what do neutrophils do for a living? Good. Eat bacteria, eat dead cells, good. You may have heard the term phagocytosis before, and that's their job, is to eat. By the way, these are the number one most common cells in terms of the white blood cell population. They make up around 60 to 70% of your white blood cell group. Now, if you happen to have an infection that you can't kick, and you go and get a blood count or a blood test, if you have elevated white blood cells, and they say specifically your neutrophils are elevated, what does that tell you about your infection? It's bad. And is it viral? Is it bacterial? It's bacterial, right, because that's pretty much their function there. All right, so here's a neutrophil, again, looking for those lobed nuclei, pale colored granules. And just kind of looking at the whole picture here, you'll notice that the white blood cells are way outnumbered by those red blood cells. All right, so our next one is called an eosinophil. An eosin is a red or orange or pink colored stain. So this time, the granules in an eosinophil stain that color, red, pink, or orange. Now, if you can see the nucleus, how many lobes does it traditionally have? Two, good. And so sometimes they're clouded out by that set of granules in there, but if you can see that nucleus, it's oftentimes bilobed, two sausage or kidney bean-shaped pieces there. So what do eosinophils do for us? Fight allergies and parasites. Good.
Over the weekend, I was studying all this stuff, and it was just by coincidence that I got on Facebook and was looking through my newsfeed, and a girl I went to high school with was admitted to the hospital for eosinophilic esophagitis. Yeah.
Really? Oh, wow.
And it was just coincidentally that I was like, oh my God, I recognize what that is, you know, and it's just kind of cool.
I don't know
what that is. I would never heard anything about it.
She okay?
It's the second time she's had it.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So they were in...
She can't swallow. She can't even, like, her own saliva or nothing. She couldn't even swallow.
Oh, God, that's
really
awful.
Painful.
I'm sure that is.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And to be young and have something like that, yeah. Just kind of give you a side note here on eosinophils. You know, they say that 100, 200 further years back in history, people didn't have allergies like we do nowadays. Anybody have an allergy to anything?
Pollen.
You know, everything from shrimp to eggs to, you know, peanuts. You can have mold allergies, all sorts of allergies out there nowadays. They are trying to figure out why do we have allergies now when we lead a cleaner lifestyle than we did, say, 100 years ago. Any ideas of what we have more of nowadays?
More food allergies,
yeah. They think that maybe we have more chemicals in the environment nowadays than we used to, and our eosinophils are busy trying to figure out what's dangerous versus what's not. And so they tend to often go berserk fighting antigens that are actually not harmful. And that's what an allergy is. It's kind of a hypersensitivity to an antigen that really isn't there to cause us harm. So if you have, say, a mold allergy, for instance, mold's not really going to cause you harm, but your eosinophils can go nuts fighting it. So that's kind of the underlying thing that they're looking at. There is a movement in immunology. They've actually tried some experiments of giving people with allergies parasitic worms. What does that do for the eosinophils?
Gives them something else to fight.
Gives them something to fight, right. So it's not like they're going to give you tapeworms and have your intestines full. They actually put a few of those worms up under your skin, where it's a fairly harmless infection, but nonetheless, they think it occupies those eosinophils and kind of gets them trained on something to do.
I'd rather deal with the pollen.
I think for life-threatening allergies, I think they're trying to do it for people who might die from anaphylactic shock. Yeah. That's a pretty one. Basophils. So what color are their granules?
Blue.
Blue, good. their granules are so strongly dyed that you hardly can see the nucleus behind it. And if you were to see the nucleus, it would be 2 to 3 lobes. But I think probably looking for the colors of the granules is the telltale sign of a basophil. By the way, these are your least common white blood cells. And so what do their granules contain?
Histamine,
right. Yeah. Histamine, it says there, is a potent vasodilator. What does that mean?
It means inflammation,
good. You know, when we talk about inflammation, we say that red, hot, swelling, and pain is a cardinal set of signs. The swelling comes from the histamine that comes from these basophils. Vasodilation means that your vessels get bigger in diameter and they relax open. And normally that's not a terrible problem if you have localized inflammation. Where the basophils can cause major trouble is if they make a lot of your blood vessels relax at the same time. Guess what happens to your blood pressure when a lot of your vessels relax?
It goes down.
Yeah. And it produces a type of shock called anaphylactic shock. And so that can cause major issues. We have swelling that can occur in the throat. Excuse me. Major loss of blood pressure. So these least common white blood cells have the capability of killing us. That's a scary thought. So yeah, those histamine granules that are dumped from those cells can cause those vessels to leak and relax and blood pressure to drop. Interesting side note here, those histamine granules are actually important for brain neurotransmitters. If you take an antihistamine like Benadryl, you feel awful, right? You feel dopey. Okay, so that's because it's blocking the neurotransmitter histamine in your brain. But nonetheless, it can prevent those basophils from dumping their granules. Alright, so let's talk about agranulocytes for just a moment. Do these have visible granules? Not really, right? The nucleus here is not lobe or sausage shaped. It tends to be more large and round, one that almost fills the entire portion of the cell. So let's talk about lymphocytes. Notice that large cell, notice that large nucleus in there. Okay, what do lymphocytes secrete?
Antibodies,
good. And those antibodies are typically matured in two locations, your thymus gland, right here above your heart, or your bone marrow. And so if they're matured in your thymus gland, we call them T cells. In your bone marrow, we call them B cells.
Are they stem cells before they ever become T cells?
They are. They're kind of stem cells, and then they can mature into whichever direction they need to go. So one more reason not to have your tonsils removed is some lymphocytes are matured in your tonsils. So after your thymus gland atrophies in late teenage years, you can actually make new T cells in your tonsils later in life. All right, so these antibodies are the same ones that fight antigens on foreign red blood cells. So we're back to that same story we've been talking about all along. And then finally, monocytes are also agranulocytes. How would you describe the nucleus here?
It's like Pac-Man.
Yep. So it's kidney-shaped, it's got a groove in there, and Pac-Man's a great way to remember it. Good. So what do monocytes do for a living?
They eat microorganisms.
Right. They're eaters, too. They're macrophages, so they also migrate to the area of infection, and then they can eat whatever is doing damage there, whatever microorganism is there. You probably have heard this before, never let monkeys eat bananas. That is the order of the white blood cells from most common to least common. Okay, so neutrophils are most common and basophils are least common. Let's see, bottom of your page got thrombocytes down there or platelets. Let's talk about those for just a moment. These are actually not whole cells. Instead, they're cell fragments formed from a really large cell. The name of that really large cell is a megakaryocyte. Let's break that word down. Mega, of course, is large. How about karyo? Nucleus, good. And then, of course, we know site is cell. Why do you think these things don't live at about 10 days? You think they have a whole complement of a nucleus and organelles as cell fragments?
If they're fragments, they wouldn't have the things necessary to be able to survive.
That's right. Yep, so if you're just a fragment, you probably can't last very long. So after about 10 days, they are removed from circulation. You'll want to highlight the number here. The common number for these is about 150,000 to around 350,000. And again, this is in a cubic millimeter of blood. Now I'm going to skip over the disorders and take you to hemostasis. We'll come back and do the disorders. Probably do those on Monday for just the first few minutes. The hemostasis process, that's on page 28. So just to kind of give you an idea of how these platelets form, if you've ever blown up a balloon and had it blow up in your face, all over the floor you have these little tiny fragments of balloon pieces left behind. That's how a platelet is. It's just these little fragments that rupture off of a megakaryocyte. This huge cell here in the center is one of those megakaryocytes. And then you can see in comparison to the red and white blood cells, they are very small since they are cell fragments. And then here they are again. Red blood cell on the left in this black and white image, white blood cell, and then there's your platelet down below. Again, just a cell fragment. So I want to take you into discussing how we can clot blood using platelets. And the name of this process in general is called hemostasis. It sounds really familiar, right? Homeostasis sounds the same, but the prefix hemo we know means blood. What does stasis tell us? Yeah, like stop, standing still. Yeah, so we're looking to stop the blood from leaving or escaping. And in terms of what we're looking at, we're really concerned about the loss of red blood cells. Why are they so important to capture and keep?
Because they will give the blood transports oxygen to the body.
They transport oxygen in the body. Good. So this process of clotting blood is going to be about a 3 to 5 minute case. You know, it's not going to be something that we're talking a major damage to a blood vessel, but, excuse me, just a minor damage to a blood vessel. Let me grab some water. I'll be right back. And we've got vascular spasms, a platelet plug, and then the final step is called coagulation. So let's say that you've nicked yourself, you've got a paper cut, minor bleed. I do want to mention that bleeds can be external and bleeds can also be internal. And we call these bleeds a hemorrhage. So the very first thing to happen is the blood vessel begins to constrict. We call that a vascular spasm. And what are we trying to do by constricting that vessel? Yeah, keep the blood from going out of the cut. So squeezing the vessel, you know, is how we limit that blood loss. All right, so that's step one. Step two is the formation of a platelet plug. So normally, platelets should not stick to the inside of a blood vessel. Why not?
Because they stuck together and all they become a blood vessel with rupture.
Yeah, so they start clinging normally, you know, if the blood vessel's intact. You're right, you could clog up that vessel from letting anything travel through. Good. All right, so why might platelets now stick? I'm going to cough again. right back. You get that tickle, you know it. You know the cough is coming. Okay. So in this previous picture, you'll see these collagen fibers and the blood vessels lining. They're kind of hanging out there when the vessel gets ruptured, and that's the only time those platelets should stick. And in this picture here, you can see they're starting to cling to that damaged site. Okay, and so what they're doing is they're forming a platelet plug, and it's a positive feedback mechanism. So platelets release a chemical called serotonin. It's a chemical message that says to other platelets passing by, help. So they scream help to their neighbors and their friends, and those platelets should come and also join this platelet plug that's being formed. Okay, so if you've ever had a minor cut, you know, you might have done two things around the house to stop the bleed. What is one thing you might do? Apply pressure, good. And that is this step, right? Vascular spasms. Okay. And the second thing you might have done is put something on there to absorb and stop the bleeding. So, you know, we oftentimes pick up whatever's lying around the house, maybe a Kleenex, maybe a paper towel, and then 5 or 10 minutes later you say, oh yeah, I need to take that off, and you pull it off, and what happens? So what'd you remove?
The platelet plug.
Yeah. How long does it take to clot?
3 to 5 minutes.
3 to 5 minutes. So if you wait longer than that, well, there goes that platelet plug, right? So if you want to avoid having your platelet plug stick to paper towel, clothing, Kleenexes, then use something like gauze or bandage. They have chemical inhibitors on those products that keep the platelet plug from adhering to it. Normally, right? Because you may have experienced having a bandage come off, and then out there comes the scab with it. So normally they're supposed to have chemicals that keep that stuff from sticking. So our goal here with hemostasis is to stop the bleeding. We have one final step that's going to occur that's more complicated than these first two. This final step is called coagulation. Let me make an issue about this word. We've talked about agglutination, right? Okay, what is agglutination? Antibodies binding antigens, right? Okay, this is totally different. Coagulation is the formation of a web or a mesh that helps to capture the blood cells and pretty much stop the bleeding. So it's the conversion of your blood from a liquid state into a jelly-like state. Okay, so that web you see in the picture here, that coagulation step, totally different from agglutination. So we're not going to go through all the details here. I just want to give you some of the highlights of how coagulation occurs. There are 10 factors numbered Roman numeral 1 through Roman numeral 10 that are interacting to help cause a clot to form. I want to tell you the weird thing about this. They don't just go number 1, number 2, and so forth in numerical order. They numbered those factors in the order that they discovered them. So it's like number 2 activates number 6, activates number 3, activates number 8.
It's a jumbled mess.
Yes, so we're not going to go there and learn that. A lot of those new drugs on the market that keep people from having clots, like Xarelto and Pradaxa, they interfere with some part of that factoring process. The important thing to appreciate is we're going to form something called fibrin. And you may recall from last class period, we talked about an inactive form of fibrin that circulates in your plasma. It's called fibrinogen. So in order to turn fibrinogen into fibrin, we need those factors. We need something called prothrombin and thrombin. And then finally, we're going to make that fibrin mesh network. I'm just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. So when you have a scab, you know, a jelly-like scab, one that's just forming, that is coagulation. Let the scab dry out, and now you've got a dry clot, right? That's all that is. And over time, maybe days or a week or so, your body begins to heal back the blood vessel, and the scab falls off. You're done. So that basically is what that clot is there for, is to act as a temporary blockage so that you don't have any more bleeding occur from that damaged site. These are red blood cells trapped in the fibrin mesh network. Here's another real picture of red blood cells trapped in fibrin. The problem is you've got to get rid of this clot after you've healed the blood vessel. So if you don't get rid of this clot, then you're leaving a clot hanging around potentially on the inside of a vessel where it can cause a blockage. And so the name of that blockage is potentially a thrombus. So in order to get rid of the thrombus, we've got to dissolve and remove the clot, and we've got to perform fibrinolysis. Okay, so let me take you back there. I've got a blank for you to fill in. In order to clot blood properly, we've got to have vitamin K and calcium. Vitamin K and calcium. And then, of course, to get rid of the clot, we have to undergo a process called fibrinolysis. It's dangerous to leave the clot in place after the body has healed the vessel. And so a stationary clot is called a thrombus. A thrombus can block blood flow. That's certainly a problem. And probably worse, if it breaks free and now is traveling, we call it an embolus. So an embolus is a moving clot. You probably heard of pulmonary embolisms, right? Yep. There's a question on your worksheet that says, below those two, how are thrombi and embolisms related to fibrinolysis? Are these two things representative of fibrinolysis working properly? I'd say no, yeah. So it sounds to me like this is incomplete fibrinolysis. So if you have a thrombus, or if you have, say, an embolism that's broken free, that points back and says, looks like we had incomplete fibrinolysis. Why don't we cover anticoagulants, and we'll just run through those blood disorders quickly on Monday. I'll do a little bit of heart anatomy for you, and then we'll open up the class period for your questions. Y'all have a good weekend. Thank you.